my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. This is 91.7 FM WHUS Stores. I am Peddlin' Ron, and you are listening to Bicycle Talk, episode 487, to be broadcast on Wednesday, June 17th, 2026, on WHUS 91.7 FM and WHUS.org. Welcome to Bicycle Talk without my friendly co-host, the lovely Dr. Fran Storch. If you are watching on Facebook Live, feel free to comment and I might be able to respond. Bicycle Talk is the show where we talk about bicycles, bicycle advocacy, bicycle culture, upcoming news in cycling, the cycling business, and the bicycle calendar. If you have a comment or you'd like to contribute information to the show, and you're listening right here on Facebook Live, you can comment down here below. If you're listening to this on an audio file, then just you can send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on WHUS.org, iTunes, Spotify, and now on my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. Ah, Ron's rant of the week. I'm stepping away. I'm stepping down from the gas thing because it looks like things are sort of settling out, but we're going to move on. So it amazes me that people are still reluctant to even try to ride their bicycle to their job in the face of these insanely high gas prices. They'd rather complain about how expensive gas is than even trying to ride a bike. Yeah, I'm shouting out to you, make you feel a little guilty, I don't know. That wasn't really my intention, but do you know what? You imagine how much obesity in our world's population would go down if we just had a few percentage of people that took these gas prices as an opportunity to ride your bicycle or take a bus for a change. But no, instead they'll just cry and use their car brain nonstop. Boggles my mind. Wake up, America. Yeah. Okay, on a positive side, I got a shout out here to Virginia Tech, which we'll get into the show, but it talks about how gas prices are fluctuating, and an expert at Virginia Tech shows how cycling continues to grow as a commuting alternative. Positive, right? Let's see what else we got that's positive. Up here in the beautiful land of northeastern Connecticut, the mountain laurels are out in full bloom. The mountain laurel is our state flower, by the way. It is more like a rhododendron or an azalea bush that's gone wild. And they can get pretty big. And we have them that are up to like 15 feet tall, 12, 15 feet tall. They're huge. And we have a preserve in Connecticut called the Mountain Laurel Preserve. And the Mountain Laurel Preserve is located in Union, Connecticut, which is the smallest town in Connecticut also. Less than 1,000 people live in Union, Connecticut. Can you believe that? In Connecticut, there's a town with less than 1,000 people. But it's true. It's all true. I was actually at a registrar's meeting last week, and I was speaking with the registrar of voters from Union, and he said they were in the low 900s right now. That's about where they are at. But anyway, let me tell you a little bit about Union, because it is one of the more beautiful places in Connecticut, a place that you would not imagine is actually even in the state of Connecticut, and has a town center elevation of 1,015 feet above sea level. It's the highest town center in eastern Connecticut and the fourth highest overall in the state. And the key elevation points for the area are, the highest point is Burley Hill, which reaches 1,316 feet. And it is the highest point in Tallinn County and in eastern Connecticut. Highway Peak on Interstate 84 reaches its highest elevation at 1,002 feet in Union. And the notable hills, this is why I'm bringing this up, the notable hills, Stickney Hill Road is the highest road elevation in the eastern part of Connecticut. Now, if you guys are listening to me out in Colorado, I get it. I'm talking baby humps, right? I know. But anyway, Stickney Hill, the elevation is 1,217 feet, and that is that's paved. Okay, so you can actually ride over this thing. I used to, back in my days that I was riding my bike a little more aggressively and had a little more time to focus on it, I used to make Stickney Hill Road a ride of the year. You know, you'd always go over Stickney Hill because it was the highest point you could go over. It's, you know, one of those conversational points. But it also brings you into the beautiful town of Union, Connecticut, where there is basically not much, which is kind of nice. So anyway, I do mention that the reason is because of the Mount Laurels. You've got about another half a week or so left of time to see them in their fullest glory. Fran and I went there yesterday. They're beautiful. Bring your climbing legs. Back to that elevation thing I was talking about. If you are planning to go visit the Mount Laurels, you may want to try on your bicycle. You might want to try from a little closer location to where they are, because you're going to spend a lot of time climbing. I think that the ride that we have for the Thread City Cyclers, the shortest ride, starts with about 1,000 or 1,100 feet of climbing. That's a lot of climbing. And it comes out to be, I think it comes out to be right around 100 feet or a little over 100 feet per mile. So it's some serious climbing, but it's beautiful up there. It's well worth the journey. It's one of the top 10 reasons why I ride my bike, because of the beauty of the area. That and a road called Kinney Hollow Road, which if you have never been on Kinney Hollow Road and you ride a bicycle, you are not treating yourself well. You really need to go check it out. It's the coolest road in northeastern Connecticut, in my estimation. Okay, so moving on to positive things. It's an important time of the year, and as many people are in need of bicycles, please support the WAME program, Wyndham Area Interfaith Ministries in Willimantic. They have a drop-off point. Go to their website and you can find out what days they are open for drop-off. They desperately need bicycles. So if you've got a bike that's been sitting around and you want to do something with it and give it to a good home, this would be a great place to go, because these bikes go to very, very good use. Okay, and it's the middle of June, positive side. What does that mean? It means July 4th is coming. We'll talk a little more about that later in the show. Yeah, it's Tour de France time, guys. Okay, more into the show. Mechanical Minute and Bicycle Tips, e-bike conversion kit project. My project. Yep, I've been talking about this almost every week now. I've been failing miserably with it almost every week now, but I finally got it to work. And so I have some evaluations and observations of which I would like to go over with today in the Mechanical Minute and Bike Tip section of Bicycle Talk. I have observations here. There is something that I will recommend, and that is I made a bike with a front wheel conversion kit. So it is a complete front wheel with a motorized hub, a 500 watt motorized hub. All I can say is wow. Also, I've learned a lot just in the few rides that I have taken on it. I've learned a lot about how to handle it, because it is different having something up there in the front versus in the back. So there is there's a learning curve. There's definitely a learning curve. I did put it on a hybrid bicycle with upright bars because of my neck situation. I'm trying to build a commuter bike. I've got a rack on the back of it. It's really all set to go. It's a perfect bike for what I'm going to be doing. One drawback is, and as I have learned this from some of the posts that are out there, is that this does have a suspension fork on the front, and it is kind of a no-no to put a motorized wheel on a suspension fork due to the amount of torque there is in the motor itself. So what I have done, I have a lockout on the fork. And if you lock the fork out, it's not a problem whatsoever. The fork's super heavy duty. It can handle the torque. I did break down and I bought a If you're watching the video, you'll be able to see that this is a stabilizer kit that you can buy that wraps around the fork and also stabilizes the axle so the axle doesn't spin out in the fork because of the torque. So I will be adding that onto it later on, but right now it seems to be working just fine. But I want to do that before any damage may occur to the fork. So the differences between a front wheel drive and a rear wheel drive are relatively obvious. All your power is coming off the front wheel versus all your power on the back wheel. Weight distribution is a big thing. So if you are riding on a bike that's got a battery that's either on the rack or on the mid-level of the bike, you've got a lot of weight right there. And then if you ride with a rear wheel and that is where your motor is, then you're going to have even more weight on the back of the bike. So it really distributes weight backwards more. By putting the front wheel on, you are able to solve that problem to a degree. So because you're spreading the weight out over the bike. Plus, if you have panniers on the back of the bike because you're using the bike for commuting, or if you're pulling a trailer or something like that, it also does change the way things handle. One thing I will point out to you, this is not a bike for going zipping around on as far as I wonder how fast I can go here, what can I do there? You have to pay attention. It requires a lot of attention to be aware of certain things. Like one thing is there's so much torque on the front wheel and so much power that if you're on a gravel situation, like a driveway or a gravel road, you're gonna find the front wheel has a tendency to spin out very easily. So I have been using, if I'm in my driveway, I use it at its lowest power level, and therefore that keeps the torque down a little bit and keeps it from going too fast. The other place is if you get off into, I decided one morning I was gonna not go up the driveway from behind my house, I was going to go across my yard instead, and it spins on soft grass too. So you just kind of have to pay attention to certain things. Maybe I'll change the tire that's on there, which will have a little bit more aggressive tread, but I'm probably going to leave it just the way it is. It's fine. You really just have to respect the power that can come out of the machine. And it's impressive. I got to tell you, it is really, really impressive. So front wheel versus rear wheel. Ron, why'd you do a front wheel versus a rear wheel? Well, rear wheels, once again, have a few more problems that go along with them. One is you got a lot of weight on that rear wheel, so rim damage can occur very easily. More so, you could have rim damage. And also, you have a higher tendency for flat tires in the rear. And when you want to take an e-bike rear wheel off, it is a game changer. you gotta really learn your way around it. So it's kind of a tough spot when you get a flat tire on the rear wheel. Far less likely to get a flat on the front wheel. And so I decided a front wheel was a way to go. The other thing about it, and the key point here, is that it's really easy to put on. It's not a difficult install. You still have all the wires. You still have all the, you know, confusing what goes where and all. And I am still working on, and this is going to be something that I hope to be able to explore soon, finding a longer bottom bracket width axle so that I have a little bit more clearance down there for the sensor that senses the drive of the wheel, because there is a sensor on there too, so you can kind of just get your pedal assist when you need it. Right now I'm sort of using the throttle more so than the pedal assist because my pedal assist unit won't fit in there. And again, I just need just a little bit, maybe 5 millimeters of extra axle that pushes out the crankset a little bit further, and then I'll have all sorts of room to put that in there. And then it ingeniously fits right into the bottom bracket area. And it's very small. You hardly even notice it's there, and it will make things better. So anyway, I'm learning. The maintenance is very little because the front wheel isn't on the power part of the bike. And I'll explain a little bit about that in a second too, as to why I particularly like this function. The design on it, it doesn't look like a regular bike. Obviously, you got this big bulky hub on the front of the bike, but it, and the rear hub would probably not be as noticeable. But there is, of course, different strokes for different folks, different benefits out there. Rear wheel drive gives you a little bit different feel as far as the ride goes, as to being pulled down the road, you're being pushed down the road. So that is a difference right there. I say once you figure out the way to ride the bike in an efficient manner, that's not a problem anymore. But anyway, we'll get to that in a second. Stability, yeah. Small bursts of sport of force from a throttle can have a remarkable stabilizing impact on really soft ground, on gravel roads. Talked about that earlier. But it definitely is, it's very torquey because it is an electric motor, and the electric motors have more torque. So therefore, you're going to have that issue. Back to maintenance, if you're using a mid-drive or a rear-wheel hub, especially the mid-drives, which I also have a mid-drive kit. It's going to go on a different bike at a different time. I just don't have time for it right now. But the mid-drives motors wear out drivetrains really rapidly. So you've got to be super careful about the amount of torque that's going into your chain and also into your cassette. And there's actually special chains that are made for e-bikes that are less susceptible to quick damage, we'll say. So, you know, there's all sorts of reasons, all sorts of ways you can handle this. When riding this bike, this is my big shout out and safety part to it. What I really love about it is that when I'm climbing a hill with this bike, obviously there's a lot of assist up there in the front end, but I'm still pushing hard on my pedal. Not hard, I'm spinning hard on my pedals on the rear wheel. So I'm putting enough work into it to get my heart rate up into zone 3, which is, you know, pretty good as far as I'm concerned. I'm not gasping for air, but I am definitely putting out some effort, and I am working at just under 80% of my max. And by putting that power on the rear wheel with your legs and then having the power in the front, you got a two-wheel drive vehicle. It's pretty cool. I like it. I like it a lot. And I find that I have more control with it when I am putting lots of pressure on that rear wheel. So I'm still pedaling the bike. I'm still working with the bike, but I get that little extra boost when I need it, especially when you get to a long hill, like a hill that goes for over a mile in length. That can really take a hold of you both physically and psychologically. So it's kind of cool, and I'm learning more about it the more I ride it. I like it a lot. I learned that you lock out the front fork, if you have a suspension fork, because they don't recommend suspension forks with these. And you gotta be careful about the steering on the bike, because if you're steering and you're putting power onto the wheel at the same time, it's gonna have a strange feel to it. So it's just different. It's not a motorcycle. It's an e-bike, and it is different. And front forks, if you're using a standard front fork, remember the front forks aren't as strong as rear dropouts are. So you got to be careful about that, because a hub motor can harm your fork over time. Although, if you are using one of those little stabilizer kits, that will help prevent that from happening. So again, I'm learning a lot. So it's kind of cool. I like it. I like it a lot. So far, so good. I commuted up to the community center a couple times last week to teach my class, and my legs were still fresh enough to be able to participate in the class, which is nice. And then, you know, I had a very pleasant ride home because it's all downhill, but and didn't have to use the motor hardly at all going back home, except when there were little rises and all. But yeah, it's good. It's a good experience. I like it a lot, and I'm gonna stick with it. I think it's gonna be a good thing. So let's get into the show and talk a little bit more about some things that have been discovered since gas prices went high. Yeah. So this is from the University of Virginia, and it is, let me see if I can find this guy, Ralph Bueller, who he's a transportation expert at the University of Virginia. And he says the war in the Middle East has driven wildly fluctuating oil prices, leading to uncertain costs at the gas pump. One easy way to avoid it is to swap out cycling for your motorized vehicle and give that a try, you know, one day a week, 2 days a week, 3 days a week, maybe every day, who knows, whatever. But it's a great thing to cycle out for when you have a modest commute or other daily travel activities. So Bueller's most recent study looked at cycling trends in a number of major cities and found that even after a pandemic-fueled cycling boom, many have seen their share of cyclists continue to increase in recent years. Good news, good news. The key reason for increases in cycling is separated and safe bikeway infrastructure. Yeah, without such infrastructure, many individuals are not willing to commit or consider riding a bike in a city. Traffic calming neighborhood streets can be shared with lower levels of slower car traffic. So making these infrastructure changes, which I preach this on the show, is the answer to all of the problems. We have to pay attention to everyone who is on the road, not just those who are driving motorized vehicles, even if those motors are, e-bikes. But anyway, the e-bike still has to be safe when it's out there riding with cars and trucks. And because of that, it's definitely a situation which can be eliminated or at least calmed down by putting traffic calming in on the streets or putting in designated bike lanes that are protected. That's really the best way to do it. In addition to saving on fuel costs, cycling can also avoid parking fees, which reduce expenditures on car insurance and maintenance while extending the life of a vehicle before it needs replacement. Cycling improves your physical and mental health, can also avoid anguish of sitting in traffic, all while easing congestion and reducing air and noise pollution. So this guy's research is a lot of what I talk about on the show every day. I have the show, so this is certainly a point which it sounds like we're beating the horse again here, but anyway, in Washington there's currently a legal fight to keep the 15th Street bike lanes open, and actually this article might have been before it was designated unlawful to close those streets, but that has happened. But infrastructure is crucial to help facilitate more uptake and provide benefits for all commuters, as is seen in Paris, London, and New York. Bike lanes and corridors are associated with greater traffic safety and fewer crashes. Separating cyclists from motorized traffic protects cyclists and reduces stress among drivers, given a cyclist a designated place to ride, and also protects pedestrians on the sidewalks. Bicycle lanes can also facilitate better traffic flow and better vehicle flow, such as cars, big box, that take up a lot of space on the roadway, according to just a number of people here. If several people switch to bikes, the space is freed up and traffic flows more freely. How do you reduce congestion? You reduce congestion. How do you reduce congestion? You ride a bike. put fewer cars on the road, more bikes on the road, and traffic becomes flowing better. This is not rocket science. This is proven. Safe infrastructure along with grassroots support make it possible to promote cycling. So all good, right? So just so you know, Bueller is a professor and chair of urban environmental planning and policy at the School of Public and International Affairs at Virginia Tech. Most of his research has international comparative perspective, contrasting transport and land use policies, transport systems, and travel behavior in Western Europe and North America. There you go. So, anyway, from the experts, from those who study this, gas prices fluctuate and cycling continues to grow. What a beautiful thing, isn't it? It's great. So, anyway, next in the show, let's see, what else do I have here? 10 things bike commuters wish drivers understood. Oh, God, this is so basic, but that's okay. We're going to go there. We're just going to go there. For those of us who ride bikes, and I am assuming if you're listening to Bicycle Talk, you're probably a person who rides bikes. So you're understanding of all these things, and you've probably been down the road, so to speak, with the issues that are faced with people who commute on bicycles. And, you know, commuting, I think it's possibly one of the most enjoyable things I've done on my bicycle. I've done a lot. I've raced and I've toured and I've crossed the country and I've done all sorts of stuff. But there's something about commuting that is more satisfying than anything else I've done on my bicycle. You just that sense of accomplishment. I got to work. I got to the grocery store. I got to the sporting event, whatever it is, all by riding my bicycle. There's just something special about that. And I can't describe it, but if you try it, you might find that it would work for you too. See, I'm always pushing this. So anyway, if you've ever ridden a bike, you probably had the experience. It happens to all of us. A driver rushes past you only for both of you to end up stopped at the same red light 20 seconds later. Ooh, I've been there before. They get an earful when they get that one. Someone leans their horn on their horn because you're taking the lane to avoid a pothole. Yeah, all these things. You know, it's just, this is all commonplace stuff that you see when you ride a bike. A close passer leaves your heart racing for blocks afterward, and while the person behind the wheel likely forgets the interaction ever even happened. The reality is that most drivers and cyclists are not enemies, even though it seems like that sometimes, especially in social media. In fact, they're often the same people. Many bike commuters own cars. Many drivers occasionally ride bikes. Yet when they're moving through a city in different ways, it can sometimes feel like we're living in a completely different world. So let's look at the 10 things that bike commuters wish drivers understood. Number one on the list, every person on a bike is one less car in front of you. Didn't I talk about that just a few seconds back? If we put more bikes on the road, there's less cars on the road. This is not rocket science, folks. This is easy stuff. The cyclist you're waiting behind at the intersection isn't contributing to traffic congestion. They're helping reduce it. Every person who chooses a bike instead of a car means that one less vehicle is competing for road space, one less person is searching for parking space, and one less car is sitting in front of you during rush hour. Starting to make sense yet? Cities often frame transportation as a competition between drivers and cyclists, but the truth is that successful cities need both. The more people that can comfortably choose a bike for short trips, the less crowded roads become for those who genuinely need to drive. All right, that's number one. Number two, close passes feel scary every single time. I had one last week. I can't believe it. You know, I'm back to commuting, back and forth to the community center. I'm out there on the roads, and I'm doing everything I can to be safe. I use radar on my bike. I use mirrors on my bike. I'm doing all the right things. And some idiot, and that's, sorry, folks, I'm not going to, I will generalize here, but some idiot in a motorized vehicle decided they needed to get as close as they could to me when they went by. Could I have reached out and tapped the car? I could have, but I was so taken back by it, because it's shocking when someone comes that close to you, that I didn't think to slap the side of the car as I usually do, which usually causes an interaction between myself and the driver, which hopefully when I'm done, and this has happened, I would say not all of the time, but probably at least 90% of the time, it has ended up with the driver of the motorized vehicle having a better understanding of what's going on out there with me on my bicycle and apologizing to me for causing the problem they did. They had no idea. I've heard it all. I had no idea. I didn't know there was a law about 3 feet. Well, how would you know? There's no way to know, because the Department of Transportation doesn't inform people about it until someone gets ticketed for it. And the only way you get ticketed for it, unfortunately, in this state, is if you hit someone on their bicycle, which is the absolute wrong and backwards way to run that legislation. But that's the way it's done here. And it just gives another fine to throw onto the ticket with the police for the police officer. Human sacrifice, that's what I call it. Inside a vehicle, it can be very difficult to appreciate how vulnerable a cyclist is, obviously. What seems to be a perfectly acceptable amount of space from behind the windshield can feel dramatically different from the saddle of a bicycle. Cyclists don't have airbags. We don't have seat belts. We don't have steel frames, crumple zones, or thousands of pounds of protective metal surrounding us, right? Even a close pass doesn't result. Even if it doesn't result in a collision, it creates stress and uncertainty. A gust of wind, a pothole, a sewer grate, or a momentary wobble can suddenly turn a routine pass into a dangerous situation. Most cyclists aren't asking drivers to slow down to a crawl. They're just asking for enough space to feel safe. Close passes. So, if I can reach out and touch your car, you are too close. Let me give you a little tip if you're driving a ginormous vehicle down the road. Even if you go out far enough to only put your front outside wheels, your driver's side wheels, on the yellow line, you're going to give me enough space to get around me. And if that is a guide point that you need to understand as a driver of a motorized vehicle, there it is. Put your driver wheels on the yellow line. That way you're not crossing the yellow line, so the cars that are coming the other way are not feeling unsure about where you're going, and I get enough space for you to get by me. Everybody's happy. It's a win-win-win. That's it. So anyway, that's number two on the list. What's number three? More bike lanes make life easier for everyone. This is something I preach about every single week on the show. We need more bike lanes. We need better infrastructure. No question about it. Protected bike lanes create predictability. Drivers know where cyclists will be. Cyclists know where they should ride. Pedestrians know what to expect from both. The result is often less confusion, fewer conflicts, and a smoother traffic flow. A street where everyone has a clearly defined place tends to function better than one where every road user is constantly negotiating for space. The best cycling infrastructure isn't anti-car, it's anti-chaos. Like that, that's good. Okay, number four, a few more miles per hour can change everything. Speed doesn't increase danger in a straight line. It increases exponentially. The difference between 30 kilometer per hour and 40 kilometer per hour may feel minor. This is a Canadian site, by the way. It comes to stopping distance, reaction times, crash severity, and small increase can dramatically alter outcomes. For someone protected by a vehicle, those differences may seem abstract, but for someone on a bicycle or walking across the street, it can be life-changing. That's why speed limits in urban areas aren't arbitrary. They are often based on what gives people the best chance of avoiding a collision altogether. If Pedal and Ron were king, right? I've said it before, you've heard it before. If Pedal and Ron were king, wherever there is a crosswalk, it is 20 miles per hour. Absolutely heavily enforced. That would be my world. Because at 20 miles an hour, I will live through impact. I have a very high chance of living through impact. But at 40 miles an hour, I have the opposite situation. So anyway, I've said it. I've said it again. You'll hear it more from me. Number five, transportation freedom means more than driving. For generations, owning a car has been associated with freedom. Really? Not me. It costs money. It's terrible. But real transportation freedom is having choices. Some people can't drive because of age or disability. Others can't afford the costs associated with vehicle ownership. Some simply prefer not to spend large portions of their day sitting in traffic. That's me. I did that for years as a sales rep in the bike industry. A city where people can safely choose to walk, bike, or take transit or drive offers more freedom than one where every trip requires a car. The goal isn't to eliminate driving. It's to make driving one option among many. Like the day it rains. You know, maybe you don't want to ride your bike in the rain, so you take your car instead. It's okay. Number six, racing past a cyclist to reach the same red light doesn't help anyone. Oh, gosh. Yeah, that's a big one. So remember, these are 10 common things that commuters wish drivers understood. So I love the racer. Yeah, I love the guy who is just behind the wheel of a car and decides that he's going to get around me as fast as he can. And in order to get around me as fast as he can, he takes all sorts of aggressive maneuvers to put himself and me and the person coming the other way in danger. Why? Because what happens when we get to the red light up ahead? I'm right alongside him again. I'm right there. So how much was gained by doing that? A driver accelerates aggressively to squeeze past only to stop moments later at a red light. Cyclist rolls up beside them and both continue on their way. In urban traffic, a time gained by aggressive passing is often measured in seconds. Sometimes it's measured in fractions of a second. Meanwhile, the risk created for the cyclist can be significant. Most bike commuters aren't asking drivers to slow down their entire journey. They're simply hoping people recognize that arriving at the next red light 2 seconds ahead justifies creating a dangerous situation. Rarely justifies creating a dangerous situation. Excuse me. And I've been in those situations where the driver blows by me like that, and then we get to the traffic light. I used to be very aggressive about it, and I used to roll right up to the side of the car and give them the look until they finally looked over at me. And that, unfortunately, turns into the exchange. And the exchange is the IQ salute. No one wants an IQ of one. And, you know, it just makes things worse. Ron's tip of the week, should you need a tip to handle a situation like this if you're driving in traffic, is to pull in behind them just like you're a car. Remember, when you're in traffic, you have to be traffic. When you're riding your bicycle as a commuter, you're really driving your bicycle. And if you think of it that way, everybody will be safer and also will be communicating better. Okay, here we go. No parking space is worth someone's life. This is number seven. Few urban planning debates become more heated than parking. Yeah, everybody complains about parking, yet we have more parking in the United States than we have cars. That's a fact. Anyway, if removing a handful of parking spaces can create a safer intersection, improve sight lines, or make room for protected cycling infrastructure, it's a worthwhile trade-off, right? The end. Cities have limited space. Every curbside parking spot occupies valuable public real estate. When communities debate on how that space should be used, the conversation shouldn't begin with vehicle storage. It should begin with safely moving people. Right. Most bike commuters, number eight, aren't trying to make a political statement. Well, maybe some of us are, but you know. Drivers sometimes assume that cycling is driven by ideology. And yes, it's hard to avoid becoming a cycling advocate once You commuted for a few weeks. It's beautiful. It's a really cool thing. But for many commuters, it's even simpler than that. Cycling can be faster than driving for short urban trips, dramatically cheaper. It provides built-in exercise. It eliminates parking hassles. And perhaps the most important, many people genuinely enjoy it. The average bike commuter isn't trying to prove a point. They're trying to get to work, pick up groceries, meet friends, or get home after a long day. The bike just happens to be the most convenient tool for the job. Yeah, just like your car. Got it? Oh boy, oh boy, oh boy. 9, car-dependent cities can be surprisingly lonely places. This final point goes beyond transportation. Every errand requires driving. People spend less time interacting with neighbors, local businesses, their communities. Streets become corridors for movement rather than places where life happens. Cyclists note things drivers often don't. The new cafe opened around the corner. The neighbor gardening in the front yard. The kids playing in the park. The local shop owner setting up for the day. Bike-friendly and walkable streets create more opportunities for all of these human moments. And while those moments may not show up in traffic counts or in transportation studies, they're often what makes cities feel vibrant, connected, and alive. Yeah, for real. So when I'm out riding my bike, just so you know, I go by someone who's working in their yard. Maybe they're planting flowers, maybe tending their garden, mowing their lawns. Of course, mowing the lawn, you can't really hear me, but now that there's electric mowers, you can. Anyway, I always recognize the person who's at the home because they probably have a car. If they're living in a house and they're out in the middle of the country somewhere, the only way they can get around, or not the only way, but the way that they've probably chosen to get around is in a car. So why not be that friendly guy on a bicycle that when they come up behind you later on, when they're out doing their errands or trying to get to work or whatever, that they reprogram their brain to the fact that, oh, that's that guy that used to wave at me all the time when he'd ride by my house. Oh, that's the guy that complimented me on how beautiful my garden was. Simple, right? Communication. The Dutch reach, number 10, takes 2 seconds and can prevent a serious injury. Do you know what the Dutch reach is? It's really, really simple. You're driving a car. You're sitting in the driver's seat, right? Traffic is passing by you, but you're getting ready to open your door up. When you go to open your door up, you traditionally take your left hand and then push the door open. Bad, 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 bad idea, because you may not see that cyclist who's coming up behind. All right. Instead, you take your right hand and you reach over. And when you reach over in front of you and to the door latch, you also look right into that rearview mirror on the side of your door and you'll be able to see the cyclist. I tell cyclists that I'm teaching, whenever I'm teaching them to ride in traffic, I tell them big thing you want to really pay attention to is you want to take very close observation of the rearview mirror on the driver's side of the car. If you see someone in there, expect the door to open. Simple, preventive. And also make sure that you're out in traffic far enough so if that door does come out, that it won't hit you. Very, very simple. That's it. So these are the things that drivers don't know about. So that's why I thought it would be a fun thing to run through this 10 things that bike commuters wish drivers understood. Yay. Thank you, Momentum Magazine. Great site. On to, yes, we are there. Let's see, how's our time doing? We're doing good. We got a little bit of time left here. Drum roll, please. Here it comes. It's the 2026 Tour de France. And of course, we have some things going on here, which I have to mention because all the teams are gearing up. They're getting their riders ready. They're competing in races as they work their way forward. And of course, teams like Visma and have riders like Wout van Aert, who is obviously a very, very strong rider and is going to be essential for the Visma team if they wish to win this year. So Wout was in the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes, and he withdrew from the Tour on June 12th, right after he had had a stage 5 win, which was outstanding. He's looking stronger, stronger, stronger. But anyway, he impressively won stage 5, but elbow and knee injuries from his accident earlier had forced, the accident was, it was a training ride. He was on a training ride. So he's been, he had that terrible accident in the cross race where he had to have ankle surgery done. And then this one comes a few weeks before the tour, and it stemmed from a crash that he had on, oh God, of course, a time trial bike, my most hated bicycle of all times. Yes, time trial bikes do not handle well, by the way. If you have ever ridden a time trial bike, you know what I'm talking about. If you are a triathlete and that is your bike of choice, you know what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter how good of a cyclist you are, that time trial bike is hard to ride. It's not made to go in, it's not made to handle well. It's made to go fast, forward, straight. That's what they're made for. So he had a crash on his time trial bike when he was out training between races. And according to Brunel, who is the team manager, he said the elbow is swollen and without real explanation. And so they shipped him back home so that he can have it looked at, because he really would like to have him in the Tour de France because he's important. So anyway, that is that. Really simple. Let's go on. We've got lots of stuff here. We've got the official Tour de France website here, all the stages. I've got stage breakdowns, all sorts of good stuff. But what I really want to do is I want to talk briefly about who are the top riders that we're dealing with. Obviously, Tadej Pogačar. Tadej Pogačar is, you know, what's more to say? He's chasing a record, equaling a Tour de France victories, and nothing about his 2026 campaign suggests he won't do it. The world champion is focused squarely on one day racing in the spring, and he collected 4 wins from the 5 classics, losing out only to Wout van Aert, just talked about him, in the Paris-Roubaix. So, yeah, you know, Tadej is hot right now. There's no question about it. He finished the Classics campaign outgunning Paul Cézas. He's another person on the list here. And the Liège-Bastogne-Liège, Pogačar eventually toggled into stage racing, made at the Tour of Romandy, despite being above his usual stage racing weight. Tadej was a dominant as ever in Switzerland, collecting 4 stage wins and an overall title. He's looking good, you know, there's no question about it. He's strong, he's powerful, he's got stupid wattage. We talked about wattage last week on the show, if you didn't catch that. These guys are off the charts, or they are the top of the charts, whatever you want to talk about. Number 2, Jonas Vingegaard, which is also above normal as far as VO2 max goes. These guys can process oxygen better than anyone I've ever seen. And you can tell by the way they spin at high RPMs going over extremely steep climbs, because they can, because they have the lungs to do it. It's really impressive. So Vingegaard, obviously he won the Vuelta a España, and he won it not with any real level of difficulty. There's been talk that maybe he didn't have the level of competition there for it, but he won 5 stages, folks. Doesn't matter. He won 5 stages of the Vuelta a España. What am I talking about? I'm sorry. The Giro d'Italia. I got confused. They're all looking at the Vuelta, but that's another story. And he's looking great. He's real fit. He's real light. Boy, is he light. He's a little guy, but he looks good. Paul Cézas from France, 19 years of age. Ooh, he's still only 19 years of age. Very young rider. I can't wait to see what's going on there. He looks like Pogačar looked when he was 20 years old. I think that with some maturity and more experience, I think we're going to have to keep our eyes on this guy because he looks great. He does. And let's see, Isaac Del Toro from Team Emirates. He's definitely a podium contender at the Tour de France. We don't hear that much about him, but he's definitely a strong rider. And he is someone that we're all going to have to keep our eyes on. He impressed by winning the UAE Tour in February and followed with an assuring triumph at Tirreno Adriato following month. And the Mexican crashed out of the Basque Country race, which ruled him out of the Adrian's Classic. But he is back and healthy, and watch out. Here he comes. And he had a crash with Cesas at the Dauphiné, and it will be even a very fascinating race to watch. I just think that there's going to be some good stuff here. Remco Evenepoel, a name that has been around for a long time, and Remco is, I shouldn't say a long time, they're still very young. But anyway, Remco is definitely in the game. He's always in the game. He is a strong, strong rider, and he is very reliable. That's one thing for sure. He has a dependable kind of presence out there. And he won the 2022 Vuelta a España, and he was third in his 2024 Tour debut. So, hey, you know, don't rule him out. He's definitely a player to look at. Florian Lipowitz. Yeah, there's another one. You see him pop up every once in a while. He's got some serious talent. He was more than happy to let Evenepoel do the talking when they sat down for a joint press conference, and the German will be pleased with how his new teammate has been drawing all the attention ahead of the tour. So he's a teammate of Evenepoel. So that is going to be a dangerous combination right there. Juan Ayuso. Yeah, Juan Ayuso is another one. He is a really strong rider, and he exited from what he termed a dictatorship of the UAE Team Emirates, and he is now riding for Lidl Trek. And he's a Spaniard, and he is strong, and now he has basically his own team. He doesn't have to fight for position on the team anymore. I think we really need to watch this guy. I think he's definitely a strong contender. Tom Pidcock, he's still there. Yeah, he's still there. He's still at it. I don't see it with Tom, but you know, they called him up here on this list, and so I figured I would mention it. Tobias Holland Johansson. He is a Norwegian who hasn't drawn too much attention to himself so far in 2026. He also hasn't fallen in any way short of the standards he set for himself last year. So I think that he is going to be one of those kind of dark horses. Once again, we'll see if we have something from it or not. The last one on the list here is Oscar Only, and he is in very good form right now. He's going to be joined with some very strong cyclists. They've got a very good team. So we never know. You know, it's a team game. It really is. It's not just an individual. It is a team game. And wow, folks, we just burned right through a full hour of bicycle talk here. So I'm going to have to start bringing things down to a halt here. I had some other things to talk about this week, but guess what? We have next week, and we can go through that. I'm going to give you a quick shout out to the Facebook Bicycle Talk page, and I have a listing there from it's from People for Bikes, and it is a full list of advocacy, U.S. bike advocacy groups, local, state, and regional. And you will see our very own Bike Mansfield on there too, on that list. So if you are looking to get involved in some sort of cycling help or advocacy work, reach out to one of these organizations. If they're nearby where you are, There's even 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 of them in Alaska, believe it or not. Yeah, Alaska, of all places. So, you know, bicycle advocacy is what we need more of. It's where we need to go. It's part of giving back to your love of your sport and helping others who are coming up along the way in the future. If we don't say something now, it won't get done. So keep your eyes on your state advocacy groups. It may not be your state advocacy group. It may be your town advocacy group. That happens too. We have many of them in Connecticut right now. And so it's definitely a cool thing to see so many towns involved with the bike walk community. So anyway, that's my little shout out for advocacy at the end of the show here today. I just wanted to make sure you knew about that. So click on the link on the Facebook page and you will be able to be drawn right over to People for Bikes. And you can also check out their site. Good organization. They're doing a lot of very, very good things. So definitely want to check that out. And we're going to kick that off the face right here. And yeah, Tour de France, tick-tock. We're 3 weeks away. That's where we're at. We're 3 weeks away, and it's going to happen soon, and we will see what the results are. I can't wait. I just can't wait. I love bike racing. I love watching it. I love the fact that we have so much more bike racing on US TV now. We're starting to see more World Cup soccer on US TV. It's like the European sports are slowly crawling their way back over here. And it's nice to see because it's just a very, very exciting sport. And I cherish the times that I spent doing it because it was a lot of fun, a whole lot of fun. Anyway, let's go back here and see if there's anything else. I'm going to pass on that because we're not there. I have a route guide stage by stage for the Tour de France, which I will start with probably next week, and we'll get through the first week of what is in front of them as they start in Barcelona, Spain this year, and they will move on from there. And it looks like it could be an exciting tour. We'll see. Let's just hope and just my personal comment, let's just hope that the promoters for each of the individual stages don't do bonehead things and put in dangerous finishes. I just hate that. I really do. I don't want to see anybody getting hurt. I don't want to see big crashes. It's not NASCAR, folks. It's bicycle racing, a far more civilized sport. Whew, wow, I said that too. Oh, well. Finishing points. Give us your opinion. Tick-tock, price track, gas prices. Where are they going? They're going up, they're going down. Depends on who's mad at who. That seems to be what's going on. Are you ready to park that car and ride your bike to work yet? How bad does it have to get before you decide, you know what, I'm going to ride my bike? You know, it all ends when you decide that your freedom begins with the thing that you discovered when you were a child, depending on your bicycle. And remember, bicycling is freedom, not cars. Life is better for everyone when more people ride bikes. Cycling is an easier and safer option for more people because when more people bike, people are happier, they're healthier, our communities are safer, they're friendlier, and our planet is greener. Together, we can all help more people know the joy of cycling. I'm going to say it again, it won't be my first time. Get out, get loud, get active. Our time has come. Stop complaining about traffic and dangerous roads and price of gas and the lack of places to safely ride. Do your part. And hey, take the Pedal and Run Challenge. Park your vehicle one day and just use your bike and you will surprise yourself. Nice stuff, huh? Anyway, the views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. You have been listening to Bicycle Talk with and without my friendly co-host, Dr. Fran Storch. If you're watching on Facebook Live, please feel free to comment, or you can send me an email at bicycletalk1@gmail.com. You can also listen to past episodes of Bicycle Talk on whus.org, Spotify, iTunes, and now my Bicycle Talk YouTube channel. This is Pedalin' Ron. Remember, keep the rubber side down, the wind at your back. Get out and ride your bike. It just could save your life. This is 91.7 FM and WHUS stores and WHUS.org. Thanks for listening. See you next week. Get on your bikes and ride!